Welcome back. Craig McClure again from the International Aid Society, and welcome you to this morning's press plenary press conference. We had another very exciting plenary today, three very dynamic presentations. What I'm going to do is introduce the three speakers from this morning, and then each of them will give a couple of minutes, quick overview of their presentations, then we'll open it up for questions and answers. Just so you're aware, again, there are headphones at the door. Elena Reynaga, one of our three presenters, will be speaking in Spanish. You are free to ask your questions in Spanish or in English, but if you don't speak both languages, it's always helpful to have one of these. The three speakers this morning were Robert Silicano, member of the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and professor of medicine and molecular biology and genetics at Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine in the United States. His plenary presentation was on HIV persistence in patients on highly active antiretroviral therapy, reevaluating the prospects for eradication. Our second speaker was Linda Richter, the executive director of Child, Youth, Family, and Social Development at the Human Sciences Research Council in South Africa. And Linda Richter's presentation was entitled No Small Issue, Children and Families. Our third presenter was Elena Reynaga. Elena is a female sex worker born in San Pedro de Jujuy, Argentina. She is the founder and executive secretary of the Argentine Association of Female Sex Workers. Its major achievements have been the elimination of police edicts which criminalize sex work and the establishment of a syndicate which gives female sex workers the status of workers. Her presentation was on sex workers. I'll turn to Bob Silicano first of all.
Thanks, Craig. So my talk was on what we need to do to cure HIV infection. And because the drugs that have been developed over the last 15 or so years are very effective and can reduce the amount of virus in the blood to below the limit of detection, there's been quite a bit of confusion about what the ultimate potential of these drugs is to cure people and how good they're actually working. Because, in fact, in all of this time, nobody, not a single patient, has been cured. One of the most confusing aspects of this is that in people who are doing well on treatment, there is a little bit of virus in the blood that is below the level of detection of the clinical assays, but can be detected with laboratory assays. And this has led people to think that the drugs are not completely controlling the infection. The main point of my talk was that new research suggests that in the optimal situation, that is when people actually take all of the drugs as prescribed, the virus has been completely stopped from replicating. And the evidence is that if you add more drugs, the amount of virus in the blood doesn't go down anymore. And what's really happening is that the virus in the blood is coming from a long-term reservoir of cells that have been infected even before therapy began. And that's the reservoir that has to be eliminated before anybody can be cured. But I think the good news is that the drugs are actually working a lot better than we thought in people who have access to the drugs and who take the drugs correctly. We really can stop the virus from replicating, from evolving, and in principle, patients who take the drugs and who don't have toxicity should be able to lead a normal life because we have stopped the virus from evolving. To cure them, we're going to have to find a way to target those reservoirs, which is the main focus of our work, and I can talk about that in more detail if there's questions.
Thank you. I'll turn now to Linda Richter.
Thank you very much. I think one of the distinguishing features of this conference is the much more measured approach and appreciation that we have of the HIV-AIDS epidemic. We now know there's no magic vaccine around the corner. There's no magic microbicide. And we're really beginning to appreciate the very long-term generational impacts that this disease is having. We're into the third generation now, and people are saying we'll go another 25 years and perhaps another 25 after that to control. I tried to make two major points with respect to that. Four points about in what way we are failing children. Prevention, although we have effective methods, are not reaching children. Treatment is lagging for children, and I illustrated that in my talk. Our concentration on orphans only, particularly when our definition of orphans means that of that group of children called orphans, 80% have a surviving parent, making it absolutely imperative that we reorient our response to protect vulnerable children. And that families are, by and large, affording this epidemic out of their own pockets and their own emotional and social reservoirs. And I made four recommendations. Firstly, that we should begin to support families as an integral part of the response into the long-term multi-generational impact that it is having on human societies. That we need to provide treatment, prevention, and care through family-centered services. That social protection at this point was a critical entry point for children. And by that I mean the package of services that protect people from becoming very vulnerable under the circumstances of HIV. And lastly, I spoke about income transfers. And unfortunately, I didn't time myself quite correctly because I had a point that I'd like to reiterate now. I did say that HIV and AIDS was impoverishing families, impoverishing communities, and with time is impoverishing countries. And that in many high prevalence settings, poverty may well be the next barrier to any further scale up of HIV/AIDS treatment and prevention. The inability of families to actually access any further provision of services without additional support. And I think the income transfer argument really needs to be looked at very seriously along a continuum from treatment allowances right through to full social security enablers like old age pension and child support grants.
Thank you very much, Linda. Obviously a very active day out there, and so we speak as close to the microphones as we can. I'll turn now to Elena Renaga, por favor.
Bueno, la presentación que nosotras hicimos ahí, quería mostrar como dos cosas, ¿no? Que cambiar la realidad de las trabajadoras sexuales se puede hacer a partir de que las trabajadoras sexuales empiezan a tener su propia voz. Y que por muchos años y todavía hoy, muchos recursos económicos que son para trabajar con las trabajadoras sexuales, primero que van como con una agenda impuesta para que nosotras trabajemos desde la victimización. ¿No? ¿Qué quiero decir con esta? Como decía, comprando máquinas de coser, con esta cuestión de querernos sacar de la calle, de este trabajo indigno, y no sé cuántas cosas dicen esas personas. Y en realidad no hay ningún dato científico que demuestre que estos programas han tenido éxito. Sin embargo, sí los hay, por eso yo mostré algunas experiencias en diferentes partes del mundo, que cuando nosotras nos organizamos y trabajamos, primero, dirigimos nosotras nuestras propias organizaciones, con errores, con dificultades, con debilidades, con errores y con aciertos también, ¿me entiendes? Ahí realmente empiezan a haber un cambio, no solamente en la prevalencia del VIH, porque si no, nosotras hace mucho tiempo que vemos que se nos ve como de la cintura para abajo, que como que hay toda una sociedad médica, algunos, voy a decir, porque estoy sentada con algunos y no quiero ofender, preocupada por la vagina de las trabajadoras sexuales, ¿no es cierto? A ver, ¿cuánta gonorrea tenemos? ¿Cuánta sífilis? ¿Cuánto VIH tenemos? Y en realidad, nosotras decimos que a nosotras no nos mata el SIDA, nos mata la violencia, ¿no? Tanto la violencia policial con la violencia de la discriminación que muchas veces se usa en los centros de salud, cuando se hacen los análisis compulsivamente y cuando han hecho un negocio de la salud de las trabajadoras sexuales, porque en este país, y para hacer y dejar nuestro granito de arena en México, queremos decir que en este país las trabajadoras sexuales son obligadas a hacerse el test de VIH, y que lo más grave de todo es que les cobran. ¿Me entiende? Entonces decimos que se saquen la careta de una vez por todas, que dejen de ser hipócritas, porque sabemos muy bien que no les hacen el análisis cada 3 meses preocupado por las compañeras trabajadoras sexuales. En realidad lo único que les preocupa es el dinero que las trabajadoras sexuales generamos. Entonces, esas son dos cosas que nosotras decimos. Los recursos a las organizaciones de base, y que nosotras tenemos voz propia. ¿No? Hemos demostrado en esta conferencia y venimos demostrando hace 30 años, porque no es que nosotras nos organizamos ayer. La historia no empezó cuando llegó la red, la historia la empezaron otras mujeres hace 30 años, como Gabriela Leiter, ¿no es cierto? Entonces, organización de base y recurso a donde tienen que ir, porque seguramente eso hará, y fundamentalmente, reconocimiento al trabajo sexual. ¿No? Y respeto a los derechos humanos, por supuesto, de las trabajadoras sexuales. Gracias.
Thank you very much. I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair and ask one question to each participant before opening up. Bob, you basically presented in your talk that the drugs we currently have are doing an excellent job eliminating HIV in cells that are active. You spoke of the long-resting latent cells that are infected with HIV and the need to make those cells active and to find ways to make them active so the drugs can work. Can you talk about the kind of approaches you're looking at and what is holding back the development of interventions to bring to life, if you like, the latently infected cells?
Yes, well, the approach that has been taken by many groups is to activate the T cell. And when you do that, because HIV's own activation is linked so closely to the activation of the T cell, then that's a way to reactivate latent HIV. But that is associated with a lot of toxicity, with the attempts that have been tried, because the immune system is really not designed to have all of the cells active at the same time. There's production of so much cytokines and inflammation and side effects that it's actually very dangerous for the patient. So we need something selective that will only turn on the cells that have latent HIV. And right now, it's not really clear how to do that. I think the thing that we can take some hope from is that we've developed better ways to study this. In the past, it's been very difficult to study these latently infected cells because they're present at a frequency of 1 in a million. And so it's almost impossible to do any mechanistic work. Now it's possible to generate these cells essentially in the laboratory in a very realistic way. And the hope is that with that improved system and possibly using the classic approach that the pharmaceutical industry has taken involving screening of large libraries of drugs, we will uncover some unexpected approach that will allow us to do this.
Thank you, Bob. Linda, I wonder if you have identified any examples, any countries that are implementing this comprehensive family-centered approach to prevent and treat HIV in children and protect them, that you would advocate for scaling up, examples of good practice.
Right, there are many more than we think, actually. Rwanda, of course, is an extraordinary example of an integrated service and a comprehensive package of protection for children. Tanzania, Kenya has scaled up to 100,000, currently to be expanded to 300,000 families. Malawi is already reaching several hundred thousand of the 10% poorest families in these kind of comprehensive approaches. At the moment, they're very much supported financially and with technical assistance from external agencies, but they have government participation. In fact, in 2006, the Southern African government signed up to what is called the Livingston Accord, which was a commitment to social protection. Budgets have been put to that. And in October 2008, they will meet again to further that agenda. And increasingly, the international agencies are coming behind this as a confluence of the interests of HIV/AIDS and development in the region, which are absolutely inextricably linked in this epidemic, both in terms of transmission and mitigation.
Thank you. Elena, you spoke about, you gave an example in India, where in Kolkata, where sex workers were, sex work was decriminalized, HIV infection, HIV prevalence dropped to very low levels, and you compared it with another city in India, Mumbai, where sex work is not decriminalized and HIV prevalence was, I think, 50%. Do you have other examples, or can you explain to us why you think that made such a difference?
Bueno, lo que pasa en África y todo eso es exactamente y lamentablemente también lo que pasa por acá, donde se supone que vivimos en países donde las culturas son diferentes, ¿no es cierto? Digo, los cambios se han dado a partir de la organización de las compañeras por las compañeras mismas, ¿no? A partir de que las compañeras se han organizado ellas mismas y han entendido que hay que empezar a denunciar el tema de la violencia que se ejerce contra nosotras y se han empoderado, porque digo, no es lo mismo que una trabajadora sexual se siente con un gobierno a decir cuáles son las realidades, cuáles son las necesidades y qué es lo que quieren, cuál es el cambio que quiere, que se sienten otras personas, porque nosotras decimos, para poder sentarnos con los políticos a decir lo que necesitamos, no tenemos que ir a la universidad, porque 30 años parada en una esquina, digo, la calle nos ha dado muchos saberes, que muchas veces los libros no los tienen, ¿no? Entonces, no solamente esta experiencia de, usted va a ver que cuando hay un país muy discriminador, muy conservador, muy pacato, que criminaliza el trabajo sexual, las prevalencias son altísimas, ¿no? Entonces digo, este es uno, México es uno, ¿no? Y entonces, otra cosa que quería subrayar yo era, ¿por qué hablé del tema de la investigación y por qué es importante que los investigadores entiendan esta cuestión? Hacen la investigación muchas veces con compañeras que no saben que están siendo investigadas, ¿no es cierto? Entonces decimos, bueno, si vos lo único, o a lo mejor te sirve los datos porque por eso lo estás haciendo, pero luego devuelven en los datos, porque nosotras lo que hacemos con los datos, y eso lo hemos demostrado, ¿no es cierto?, es incidir ante los gobiernos para la acción, porque si no estamos cansadas, que digo, hay un país que lamentablemente no lo puedo decir, pero ya lo van a saber porque ONU SIDA lo va a publicar, hay un país de la región andina que se gastó en estos dos últimos años, 48 millones de dólares en investigación. ¿Sabe cuánto se gastaron en prevención? 8 millones. O sea, usted vea la diferencia. Ahora, muchas de las poblaciones que han sido investigadas no saben que han sido investigadas. Entonces, no van a poder, nadie va a poder hacer la acción, nadie va a poder exigir la acción. Entonces, por eso nosotros le decimos, los técnicos, el saber tiene que ir combinado con la experiencia. Los dos nos tenemos que juntar, nos tenemos que aliar para realmente hacer un cambio posible en el tema de la prevalencia del VIH y los derechos humanos.
Muchas gracias. Okay, I'd like to open it up now. Please state your name and your media house before the question. Here at the back halfway. Yes, you. Microphones. We have microphones. No, back. Right there. Thank you.
Buenos días, soy Karina Vilés del periódico La Jornada, de aquí de México. Tengo tres preguntas. Una es...
Just one question, sorry.
Bueno. A la doctora Richard, Le quería preguntar si pudiera abundar sobre estas cifras y de cómo está empobreciendo a las familias la pandemia, y por otro lado, o en contraste de esto, ¿quiénes son las grandes beneficiarias de la enfermedad, ¿no? Y con cuánto se han beneficiado en los últimos años, y tienen algún dato preciso de los millones que han, mientras unos se enferman, otros ganan bastante justamente con la pandemia, ¿no?
Can I go ahead? Yes, thank you very much. One of the big arguments for income transfers and social protection systems directed to very vulnerable families is to ensure that more of the money that is being released in the HIV/AIDS epidemic to benefit beneficiaries actually reaches them. You would have already seen the report that 70% of PEPFAR funds are actually paid to international agencies. That is an incredibly inefficient way of moving money down to people who need it. It's very difficult to track that money and to see how each intermediary organization or consortium is using that money and how much eventually trickles down. Income transfers are a very direct way of getting money to people who are vulnerable because it doesn't go through many translations. Money arrives in countries, whether it's for education, for roads, or whatever. It has to be translated. It translates many, many times. If you provide food to the poorest families, they often reconvert it into cash. So there are many ways in which money decreases in value if you don't provide it directly to families. Now, when we look at income transfer programs, I mean, you have an exemplary one in Mexico, Oportunidades, which is a well-studied and experimentally well-studied program with very good results showing the benefits to children's health, education, nutrition. When we study those income transfer programs, we see that that money, when it reaches households, is extremely well used. 80% of it buys food. Other parts of that money go to paying for education supplies for children. So we do know and have good evidence that families benefit very directly from income transfers. We don't have a lot of evidence that families benefit from large amounts of money released into international organizations for programs.
Thank you. I will try to come back to you if we have time. Next question, otra pregunta. Larry.
Larry Altman, New York Times. One, you're saying you're challenging current paradigms in how to improve the lives of children, and you're talking about income transfer. But income transfer is a jargon phrase. Could you just spell out more directly what you mean by that and how you're challenging the...
Thank you. Back to you, Linda.
Thank you, Larry. Yes, I think there is a paradigm shift in from provision of services to ensuring that families actually have the wherewithal to access those services. We can't simply provide services if families lack the capacity to do that. And this is what is driving the income transfer movement. Now, income transfers, why I use that word, I mean, you know they've been used, cash transfers. You have Opportunities New York, which is this very interesting program happening that is incentivizing the use of benefits for children. But these social protection programs, which is perhaps more accurate to speak about, can, you know, span a very wide range. Germany introduced them in the 1890s as really as insurance programs when people were injured on duty or injured at work. They were then expanded into old age pensions. They can take many forms. They can take the forms of allowances, of subsidies, direct cash to households. And I think every country has to look at its own situation and decide what sort of thing it wants to introduce. But treatment allowances, for example, it's almost becoming imperative that if people don't receive small amounts of money to benefit from ARV programs, they cannot keep up their adherence levels because it costs them to get to clinics to receive medication. It costs them to buy extra food to maintain the level of effectiveness of the drugs. So, Larry, without committing oneself to a particular form of these transfers, it really is a very wide spectrum.
I'll take a question here, please.
Sou Flávio de Brasil, beijo da rua, beijo de la calle, street kiss. Me gostaria de saber de Helena, que motivo crees que tu ponência ha provocado tanta explosão e emoção hoje por la mañana? And I also would like Mr. McClure to comment on that. Thank you.
¿Qué motivó tanta emoción? Supongo yo que estaba, porque estaba hablando alguien que es una trabajadora sexual, que ha intentado en estos 14 años que milito, a pesar de un montón de dificultades, poner la voz de todas las compañeras, ¿no? Yo ahí era solo la cara visible. Mi ponencia era una demostración que estaba hablando en nombre de las trabajadoras sexuales del mundo. No estaba solamente diciendo qué es lo que pasaba en América Latina ni qué es lo que pasaba en Argentina. ¿No es cierto? Estaba hablando de lo que pasa en el mundo. Y creo que por eso las compañeras, y también era una sorpresa para todas mis compañeras, porque salvo la coautora, que es Ana Luis de Canadá, nadie absolutamente sabía lo que yo iba a decir, ¿no es cierto? Así que supongo que ver las fotos de todos los países, las organizaciones, los resultados, el trabajo que se tomó el equipo de la Retrasé para recolectar todos esos datos, fotos y todo, para mostrar la realidad en el mundo. Supongo que es eso. Y también, modestia aparte, porque no soy políticamente correcta cuando digo las cosas, ¿no? Digo lo que me sale del corazón, porque creo que hay que decir las cosas como son. Y entonces, me supongo, no sé si te contesté, Flavio, pero creo que esa era la exclamación. También hubieran otras voces, pero que no entendieron.
There were different types of excitement. I think in the plenary hall itself, which seemed to me like it was packed with 7,000, 8,000 people, what I heard was an enormous roar of approval that finally, after 25 years, at the International AIDS Conference, a sex worker who had become a leader around the world around sex workers' issues was speaking about sex work, rather than a researcher who had never done sex work or a policy analyst who had never done sex work. So there was a roar of approval at the conference, enabling a leader who herself is a sex worker to speak about what works to prevent HIV transmission amongst sex workers. If you were referring to the little demonstration at the front with three women sex workers from Mexico, that was about their desire for a Mexican to speak about sex work issues. But we need to remember this is not a Mexican conference. It's an international conference that has many Mexicans speaking at it. But so, for me, the most important thing was that roar of approval for all of the organizers, including the IS, that we had put a sex worker on the stage to speak about sex work. Can I take another question, please? Any more questions? Martin. And then we'll go to you in the back. Okay, go ahead. Where's the
Gracias. Osiris de Gante, de México, y la pregunta es para Helena. Bueno, yo he tenido algún seguimiento al trabajo sexual aquí en México. Le he dado un seguimiento. Y según investigaciones, el 5% solo en un estado en particular, uno de los más grandes, es trabajadoras sexuales portan VIH. Me gustaría tener una cifra a nivel Latinoamérica, porque yo tengo un supuesto, ¿no? Que obedece más a estigma que a cifras, ¿no? Pero ¿cuál es la cifra, si es que existe en América Latina, portadoras del virus en el trabajo sexual, que, repito, es más por estigma que por cifras.
Si usted quiere bajar la cifra, honestamente en este momento no tengo ninguna, porque como no somos científicas no nos ocupamos de eso. ¿Me entiende? Lamentablemente hay más cifras de asesinato de trabajadoras sexuales que de trabajadoras sexuales viviendo con VIH. Entonces estamos tratando, porque parece ser que los gobiernos o algunas agencias necesitan datos científicos para empezar a hacer algo con alguna comunidad, ¿no es cierto? Entonces nosotras estamos trabajando en el tema de cuántas compañeras van detenidas por día, cuántos días van detenidas, ¿Cuántas compañeras viviendo con VIH por tanto tiempo que van detenidas no pueden tener la medicación? Todo eso lo vamos a hacer para ver si una vez por todas los gobiernos se dan cuenta que la represión y la prohibición en realidad va atenta, ¿me entiende?, contra el tema de la prevalencia del VIH-Sida en trabajadoras sexuales y en personas trans. ¿Me entiende? Así que las trabajadoras sexuales tenemos los mismos problemas que tienen todas las mujeres, chicas. ¿Me entienden? No es que la mayoría, le diría yo, de las trabajadoras sexuales, como lo he demostrado en la presentación, se cuidan en el trabajo sexual. Pero ¿saben qué? Como también somos seres humanos, como también somos personas, como también somos mujeres, nos enamoramos de vez en cuando. Pero lamentablemente vivimos en países terriblemente machistas, ¿me entiende? Y cuesta mucho, cuando uno se enamora muchas veces, y eso no es una cuestión de las trabajadoras sexuales, sino de todas las mujeres. Maestra, ¿me entiende?, hasta médica, y lo digo con conocimiento de causa, que a la hora de enamorarse o a la hora de buscar el afecto y tener sexo, muchas veces bajan la guardia, y cuando bajaron la guardia se infectaron, ¿me entiende? Entonces, nosotras las mujeres, en vez de vernos una de la vereda de enfrente, ¿no?, nosotras las malas y vosotras las buenas, lo que tenemos que es empezar a comunicarnos, porque podemos hacer mucho juntas las mujeres, por las mujeres.
Thank you. Martin, do you have a microphone?
Is this on? Yeah. My question is to Dr. Siliciano. It's whether your research has revealed any new news on viral latent reservoirs of HIV in the genital tract and any continued infectiousness despite undetectable viral load in patients in the blood, and whether this is then able to give a message that people can have sex safely without condoms. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Are you referring to people on treatment?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, have you revealed any new research about the latent reservoirs of HIV in the genital tract through your research?
Not in our own research. Yeah. I think there's a general feeling that lymphocytes, including these resting T cells that harbor latent HIV, are widely distributed throughout the body, are likely to be in every organ at some concentration. And in terms of the issue of whether they could contribute to transmission in people on treatment, I mean, the reality is that the lower the viral load, the lower the likelihood of transmission. But because of these reservoirs, even in a patient with suppression of viremia to below the limit of detection, there is a possibility of transmission. That's certainly what we counsel our patients, and I think that's the wise thing to say.
And just to follow up, Dr. Siliciano, there was a report just before the conference in the International Herald Tribune that claimed, quite wrongly in my mind, that the HIV field doesn't care anymore about cures and eradication. And your talk clearly spoke to that issue and said to me that eradication is something we are all very concerned about, and that may in fact be possible.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that after all of the excitement following the introduction of HART, there was a great disappointment when reservoirs were identified that would prevent cure, even though the drugs reduced the amount of virus in the blood to undetectable levels, and that almost led to a point where people were afraid to talk about it. And I think there still is a danger in talking about it and people thinking that it's going to be easy to do. So what I'm trying to say is that, you know, we can break this down and do it in a stepwise fashion. And what's, I guess, impressive to me is that the first step, which is you have to stop the virus from replicating, that actually is done. Now, it may be much harder to find these reservoirs, and I think it's clearly, like a vaccine, it's something that we are obligated to try and work on, and who knows how long it will take. But the first step has actually been accomplished, and that also has implications for everybody who's got HIV. It means that if those people have access to the drugs, and if they take the drugs, they will not develop AIDS.
Fantastic. I think we can take another question back. Sorry.
I'd like to, Don Messer, United Methodist Communications. I'd like to speak to Dr. Richter. I appreciated your comment about income transfer for nutrition and travel. It seems to me that nutrition and need for food is consistently overlooked in the matter of treatment. In India, I was in centers in rural India where they get World Food Program foods, but it's not the food that people like to eat, and there needs to be money to help them fix it in a way. So the food goes to waste. In Malawi, I've seen there's thousands and thousands of school children getting no food. What do you recommend, and what positive examples? I mean, the United States, the McGovern-Dole International Food Program was cut for school children at the very time we're talking about increasing nutritional help. So there's an enormous difference, and your help is appreciated.
Nutrition remains an enormous problem in most poor countries. I mean, where, you know, a third to a half of all children are stunted, with long-term consequences for their development, for their schooling, for their employment. I mean, we've recently published in The Lancet showing the income effects of early stunting and poverty. There's no doubt, though, that what we're trying to achieve in the response to HIV is a balance between provision and demand. If our emphasis continues in what we're spending the money on provision, without simultaneously increasing the capacity of families and individuals to respond, to get the provision, we're not going to get any further than we are. I mean, in some southern African countries, we are talking about perhaps reaching the plateau in how much provision can further. There is a big debate going on now about food, the provision of food versus the provision of money, particularly with rising food prices and the neglect of agriculture in many of the poor countries over the last decade. That assistance has both within country and from abroad, has not supported the level of agricultural development we should have. However, it seems where there are functioning markets, and some economists quip that a functioning market is where you can buy a Coke, where there are functioning markets, you need to continue to give money rather than food, that families more efficiently use money to purchase the foods that they need, the foods that they like, the foods that can last and be preserved, and that in many cases where food is provided, it is inefficiently translated into money. It's sold to near neighbors and so on. The only difference is where food is given to school children. That seems to be a very efficient transfer. And it does mitigate hunger, but it doesn't mitigate stunting. Stunting occurs in the first 2 years of life. That's nutrition in the home. And that's where you have to ensure that families are being able to maintain their consumption levels, particularly for very young children.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid that's all the time we have. You may want to speak to the presenters individually and can discuss with Karen if that's the case. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thank you to our presenters.